Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It began in London. It spread to cities around the United Kingdom. 4 nights of wild rioting, the worst in a generation. Burning, looting, sacking whole city blocks. Alan McCabe in London's Croydon district, in the midst of some of the worst, spoke here.
It's just everything's exploding around. There's just sirens and smoke everywhere and helicopters everywhere. And I've seen about 10 minutes ago another 20-odd riot police heading down from the top of the high street down towards West Croydon. It's an absolute war zone. I've never seen anything like it.
Last night, quieter in London, but not in Manchester, Liverpool, Birmingham, and beyond. It's been an astonishing explosion. But of what exactly? Class uprising, criminality, hopelessness, hooliganism? This hour on Point, the London riots and beyond. You can join the conversation. What do you see in the smoke and fire and smashed glass of the UK, of London? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll look at the big strike of Verizon telecom workers here in the U.S. But joining me now from London is John Burns, Pulitzer Prize-winning London Bureau Chief for The New York Times. He's been home from Baghdad and covering the riots in his own home country. John Burns, welcome back to On Point.
It's a pleasure.
With us as well from London is Bim Adewunmi, British journalist and blogger. She lives in Hackney, a borough in North London that's been the site of intense riots and looting. She's been posting real-time updates on Twitter. Bim, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you. Hi there.
We'll hear in a moment from Laurie Penny, a fiery interpreter of what's been going on in the UK. But John, first to you, just on the facts, where does it stand in London at this point, and what are the expectations for the evening to come?
Well, David Cameron this morning spoke of a fight back by the police and indeed by communities themselves against this. And the evidence as we talk right now is that the fight back is beginning to prevail. London is mostly quiet at the moment. They have a 24-hour court beginning to process people through, hundreds of people through the court. Of course, there's continuing trouble in the provincial cities that you named, Birmingham, Manchester, Liverpool, and it's very, 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 very delicately poised. It could yet go either way.
This began with the shooting death of a young man by British police, protests in front of the police station that then erupted and went wider and wider. John, you know this city, this country well. What do you make of what's happening here?
Well, I think that it's a coming together of a whole series of things. The shooting of the young man in Tottenham, and then on this, in this I rely on community representatives, residents of the areas that have been hit by the riots, members of Parliament who sit for those districts, many of them from the Labour Party opposition, and at least some of them from the same Afro-Caribbean community in which the anger over the shooting of Mark Duggan last week first erupted, are saying that this has nothing to do now any longer with the killing of Duggan, which is being investigated by an independent police oversight body, which has already released information very uncomfortable for the police about how the initial accounts of the police only having opened fire after being fired upon are inaccurate. They can't be sure that the weapon held by the young man in question was not fired, but they do know that the two bullets that they have found were both from a police weapon. So I think we can discount the notion that this is all in reaction to the alleged unlawful killing of Mark Duggan. It goes to much deeper things. And, of course, it goes to joblessness, hopelessness, despair, running back over decades. But it also goes to something else, which is a kind of indiscipline, a kind of anything goes, a kind of feral, if you will, quality that anybody who's walked the center of any British city or town after dark knows very well. And it's going to take years to sort through all of this.
I want to come and look at that further. But Bim Adewunmi, give us a sense. I mean, you live in Hackney. This is an area that had very serious problems. Just give us a sense, if you'd be good enough, of what it was like, what it's been like to be in the midst of this rioting, looting, fire, all the rest.
Well, it's been a weird few days. I think I was at home because I'm a freelance journalist, so I was working from home. So I was pretty much at home when the thing began, when it all started. And the first inkling was when I looked on Twitter, and there were a few people reporting stuff, and I recognised the places they were talking about. There were a few streets over from where I live in Clapton.
Yeah.
So the first thing I did was basically turn on the TV, and there was some images from BBC News, and it showed a few people kicking in and attempting to smash the windows of a betting shop on Mare Street, which is quite a busy thoroughfare in Hackney. And then from then on, it kind of escalated quite quickly. But this started during the daytime, which I hadn't been expecting. But prior to that, I'd seen some tweets talking about some people had received some messages saying that things would be kicking off in Hackney, in Mare Street specifically. But I hadn't given it much thought until I began seeing the images on screen. It's a weird thing. I went out the day after Hackney had its trouble and was talking to neighbours and locals and, you know, and everyone just seemed kind of a bit shell-shocked, but not shocked especially at the feeling that exists in Hackney. What I think they were perhaps a bit taken aback by the ferocity of it, but in reality, no one seemed, you know, especially shocked about the fact that people were this angry or this disenfranchised. That didn't seem to be what I got from the people I spoke to.
There's a lot to dig into here, but John Burns, let me ask you first, just on the front of the police. Now, David Cameron, Prime Minister, is talking about a fight back policy now. 16,000 police in London last night, part of the reason that it was quieter there, but of course some of them drawn from other cities that had flare-ups. From an American perspective, looking at the video images out of London, it seemed like we saw an awful lot of police. I mean, there were horse charges here and there, but a lot of police kind of just standing by while looting took place right in front of them. It's been hard for, I think, a lot of Americans to understand exactly what goes on, the dynamic with law enforcement there, John. Can you explain that to us?
Well, of course, that's going to be at the heart of the inquiries that will now stretch forth, as I said, probably over a number of years. Mm-hmm. But a preliminary diagnosis of that is that the police in London have been on the back foot now for many years over their alleged and sometimes actual and realized mistreatment of ethnic minorities in particular, right up to and including an incident only 2 or 3 years ago in a G20 a summit meeting of finance ministers in London, in which a news vendor was attacked, in effect, by a police officer who's now on trial. Those sorts of things and incidents much more serious and widespread than that, going back over 30 years, have generated a tremendous inhibition in the police about what is called here robust behavior in the face of disorder, crowds, protests, and riots. You add to that the fact that they are definitely under-equipped. They're not just undermanned, as we have seen, but they're under-equipped. No water cannons. A lack of sufficient numbers of properly trained riot police. A inhibition about using tear gas. And as a result, what you found was police, especially in those first couple of nights, who were outnumbered, who were armed only with truncheons, nightsticks, and who in many cases were literally driven back. And about 40 police officers have been injured, some of them seriously, none yet, I have to say, killed in all of this. So I think there's a dawning realization that the whole question of riot control and of the manning and the equipping of the police is going to have to be reviewed.
John, I wish we had you longer. I'm really interested in something you said earlier. You described as a feral quality to some of the young people in the streets. Now, that is very interesting language. Language I don't think you'd hear an American reporter use to speak about Americans in the streets here. What is feral? That's animal.
Well,
that's bestial.
As an Englishman of Scots descent,
yes,
who returned from several decades as a foreign correspondent, mm-hmm, abroad, in much of it in very distraught areas and indeed in war zones, coming home, as I did, to be the London bureau chief, to work here,
yes,
for the first time in my life, as it happened, was a very mixed experience. There are some delightful things about this country that make me very proud. There are other things which have been a huge disappointment. I carried an idyll of Britain, if you will, in my backpack with me around the world for 40 years. The Britain I grew up in, I thought we were the most civil people on earth. I thought we were the most polite people on earth. I thought we were a very well-ordered civic society. And against that measure, much of what I've experienced in the last 3 years or so has been a great disappointment. And yes, there are contrasts to be drawn with the United States. I have not personally experienced in American cities the degree of tension and apprehension that you do find in many inner city areas in Britain. And it's not at all or even mainly ethnic minorities. Many of these young people who prowl the streets in their hoodies, as you'll have seen from the riot coverage, young white people, many of them, yes, unemployed, but some of them not. It's quite interesting to see that in the people who are now being processed through the courts, there are a significant number, I won't say a majority, but a significant number of people who have jobs. This afternoon, for example, there was a teacher's assistant who was led out of the Highbury Court in London after having faced a magistrate trying to hide his face with a copy of the evening newspaper.
John Burns, please stand by with the New York Times in London. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking about the riots in London and beyond in the UK, why they've happened, what they've meant, what we're seeing in night after night of fire and looting. John Burns of the New York Times is with us, London Bureau Chief, Pulitzer Prize winner for the New York Times. Bim Adewunmi is with us, freelance journalist and blogger. She blogs at YorubaGirlDancing.com. We'll have more in just a moment, but here, just the sound of the incredible scenes in the streets of London and beyond in these last few days. Monday night, a resident of Clapham Junction described the chaos in his London neighborhood to the BBC in real time. He said the police were not helping.
Well, right now, my house is on fire. My neighbour's house is on fire. It's absolutely bedlam on the streets. People have been openly looting this area for an hour, 2 hours at least, since I got here. And the police are seemingly ineffectual. They've done nothing.
Tottenham resident Rizwana Hamid blamed the riots on tensions between ethnic and racial groups, crammed into close quarters. Here she is on NPR.
That sense of animals being caged in this dense area leads to a boiling up of tensions and an outburst of what we saw on the other night.
And on Tuesday morning, the BBC's Liana Hosea talked to two girls who had participated in the riots in Croydon in London, one of the worst hit areas. Hosea asked why they were looting and destroying their own neighborhoods.
Why is it targeting local people and your own people?
It's the rich people. It's the rich people, the people that have got businesses, and that's why all of this has happened, because the rich people. So we're just showing the rich people that we can do what we want.
We can do what we want. We're showing the rich people. John Burns, I had to interrupt you there. I'm sorry for that break. But you were saying about the nature of what's unfolding, what we're seeing here.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt that there has been a powder keg. And we can't lose sight of the social, if you will, and cultural underpinnings of this and of the particular deprivation and distress that there is in our cities. And there's no doubt it's pretty acute, and Americans will be very familiar with that, going back to my first acquaintance with America 30 or 40 years ago. So there's all of that, but there is also, and it's an unfortunate and perhaps incendiary word, but it's the common word used in the tabloid newspapers here. There's this problem with feral youth, and there's this problem with anger and, if you will, indiscipline, a state education system which in many respects has failed dismally. We have some of the worst educational outcomes in Europe, which is astonishing to somebody who grew up in a country which was proud of having what was then arguably the best education system in Europe. There's a very widespread feeling, and not just amongst people of my age and people who are well-employed and well-financed, there's a very wide feeling that there's a culture of indiscipline in this country, of shirking responsibility, to use a phrase that the Labour leader, Ed Miliband, a man who came out of the left wing of the Labour Party, whose father was a Marxist intellectual, who I sat down with a few days ago, and he, at that time, was talking about the Murdoch newspaper scandal here, but drawing much wider conclusions, which I think apply also, as does he, to the current situation, that if you have bankers ripping off millions, if you have members of Parliament who think it okay to milk their expenses, and you have press barons who preside knowingly or otherwise over a culture of criminality, as appears to have happened here now for many years, is it any surprise that that spreads all the way down the system to young people who think it okay to simply smash the windows of department stores and go in and help themselves to flat-screen television sets?
Bim Adewunmi, what do you make of this kind of framing of this as an outcome of feral youth and a culture of indiscipline? What do you say, Bim?
I think there is perhaps a kernel of truth in that. However, I think it's something that has escalated. This is not a new situation. This didn't arise overnight. There has been a generation of people who have long been forgotten. And I'm not talking even about so much as the people who were perhaps, I think the people who were affected the most are not the ones who were even looting. We're talking about the working poor who exist in these societies, who perhaps have even been terrorized in their own communities by some of these people who were out looting and out rioting. I think it's a system. The system has failed a number of people. I think it's there's been legislation, I think, that allows people to basically it's cheaper, I think, to herd poor, disaffected people together. I was speaking to my sister, and she was explaining how one of the things that is most difficult to do is getting a child excluded. It is cheaper for a child to remain in the school. It's cheaper not to exclude, because once that child is out of the school system...
Exclude, you mean leave what we call the public schools and go to a private school? Is that what you mean?
No, we mean... by that I mean to be sent home from school, to be excluded, basically. So you have bad behavior.
Disciplined by being sent home.
Yeah,
okay.
Well, basically, yeah, where you're basically... You're advised not to come back to school.
Yeah.
Due to whatever behavior. But it's cheaper not to. It's cheaper to not exclude students, because once you exclude a child, there has to be a system in place for that child to basically exist outside of a school system. Mm. You get penalized by Ofsted, which is the inspection board for schools. The thing is, what London saw on a wider scale over the last few days is something that many communities we've been seeing for a very long time. Part of it is to do with disaffection, sure. Some of it is to do with anger, the idea that people are out there living lives. And perhaps there is a sense of entitlement, perhaps. But it's something that has been building for years. I've lived in East London all my life, except for the period where we lived abroad. But we came back and we stayed in pretty much the same neighbourhood. Right now, I live 20 minutes from the house I grew up in. And next door to Hackney is another borough called Newham, which is filled with similar situations, you know, low education rates, high unemployment, you know, high child poverty. And this is not just London-wide. This is, you know, UK-wide and Europe-wide.
Is it racial, Bim? Your family has a Nigerian background. You've got that perspective.
Yeah.
Is it racial or not? John Byrne says he sees plenty of disaffected young white youth in the streets.
I agree with him. There are plenty of disaffected people. I don't think it's purely to do with race, but there is some crossover between race and, I suppose, class, socioeconomic class. So you can't discount it. And it's a fact that if you are a young black man in London, you are 7 times more likely to be stopped and searched. My brothers have both been stopped and searched. Just by virtue of walking around in their own neighborhood.
Yeah.
That
creates a kind of tension that we know well here in the United States as well. Bim Adewunmi and John Byrne, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation, also from London, if I may, Laurie Penny, journalist, blogger for The New Statesman, contributes regularly to The Guardian. Her blog is Penny Red, was shortlisted for the Orwell Prize for political writing last year. Laurie Penny, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
You've been making a pretty full-throated interpretation of your own about what's going on, and it's not the Prime Minister Cameron's interpretation. You're saying this is much more than criminality or hooliganism. What do you see happening here, Laurie?
Well, I think first it's really, really important to acknowledge that we have a lot of social division in this country, and particularly in London, where lots and lots of different communities live on top of each other and have really very little experience of what it's like to live lives akin to their neighbours. So it's quite difficult, you know, being trapped in the house like I was on Monday night and Sunday night, watching all of this stuff go on the television and hearing the sirens outside and, you know, the noise of, you know, rioting coming closer or rumours, that it's difficult to understand what motivates people. And it's really, really important to acknowledge that, because what worries me is that over the next few weeks and months, everybody from across the political spectrum is going to try to impose their own political ideas on these riots and on what's happening at the moment. I mean, you see David Cameron and Boris Johnson, Mayor of London, and other, you know, other politicians immediately coming forward to say that this has absolutely nothing to do with social unrest. It's got nothing to do with civil unrest, which is another name for rioting on this scale. Mm. The insistence that this is pure criminality, which is, as a friend of mine put it to me yesterday, it's a bit loud. It's a bit like blaming a war on violence. You know, it misses the point. You know, pure criminality, I believe, doesn't exist. I believe that no violence is mindless.
Let me ask you about two interpretations, if I may. First, Mary Riddell, mm-hmm. writing a column in The Telegraph. That's a fairly conservative London paper.
Yeah.
Headline, London riots, the underclass lashes out. And she wrote, successive British governments have colluded in incubating the poverty, the inequality, and the inhumanity now exacerbated by financial turmoil. She writes, the lost generation is mustering for war. But then on the other hand, Wall Street Journal here in the States, Murdoch-owned newspaper, headline today on the editorial page, hooligans, not social grievances, are driving the British riots. The Wall Street Journal editorial writers say these are not 18th century sans-culottes run out of bread. They aren't Greek communists destroying property to demand continuation of the welfare state. It's hooliganism, pure and simple. Laurie Penny, that's the Wall Street Journal view. What do you say?
Well, I think it's clear from a lot of the language of the Wall Street Journal and the language that we're hearing a lot in the UK. I mean, John Burns just used the phrase feral youth, which is a really, really damaging, worrying thing to say, I believe, because it smacks of class hatred. A lot of what we've been hearing smacks very strongly of race hatred.
Yeah, but it's interesting. I've heard it not just in John's mouth, but I've heard it a lot from the UK. I saw someone on network television news in the United States last night saying feral rats.
Yeah, feral rats. That's what people... I heard that too, and I think it was absolutely disgusting. I think what worries me is that people here are starting to show the true colours of a deep social conservatism and a deep suspicion of other people in the community. I mean, you have on... a YouGov poll today came out showing a third of the British public support using live bullets on rioters out on the street. And, you know, loads and loads of people are saying, you know, bring back the water cannon, bring out the rubber bullets. And, you know, David Cameron himself, in his speech, he said today, you know, we don't want to be worried about civil liberties when we're policing these riots. I mean, that's a monumentally worrying thing to say. And to absolutely dismiss any sense of politics, any sense of a social context to these riots, whilst at the same time saying that these young people are entitled, they believe that the world owes them something, which is what people are saying. That statement is political. It's political to say, to impose your own ideas on these young people, saying they're rioting because they're good for nothing and they believe that, you know, the world owes them something and, you know, that we should have more responsibility. And then what's interesting is you heard the Prime Minister, you know, and other politicians talk, saying that there's no social context, then talking about responsibility and parenting, and then leading fitting that in to the ideology of austerity, the ideology of welfare cuts, the programme of reduced public spending that's coming in, saying, oh, you know, as long as we carry through these wildly unpopular government plans, everything will be okay.
Americans watching this with
a very, very dangerous trend.
Yeah, watching this with a lot of interest here. Laurie Penny, please stand by. John Burns, I want to come to you here. Let me get a caller first, if I may. Varda in Norwich, Vermont. Varda, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Dom.
Hi.
Yeah, I have to agree with this lady. I think this is almost like the canary in the cage. These are desperate people. These are, I believe, acts of desperation. And the more austerity we have imposed upon us, when there's such a wide disparity of wealth, we're going to see more and more of this around the world, especially in the developed nations where people have to live side by side by those who have a lot and then those who have very little. It doesn't make sense to me that austerity measures are being imposed on the poorest people while the richest people are not having to pay their fair share in all the countries. And we are the erosion of the middle class is going to have a huge economic ripple in all kinds of ways. Purchasing power, people buying cell phones, computers, airlines tickets.
And that may be just the least of it at some point, if it is indeed a canary in the coal mine. We don't know. But, Varda, I appreciate your call. John Burns, just on the facts first, on the austerity measures in the U.K., I think a lot of Americans don't fully realize what's underway there in terms of, I mean, we're talking about big spending cuts here, but they've already done it in the U.K. How has that potentially, or how has it hit the class of people who we now see in the streets?
There's quite a lot of argument about that. In some communities, these cuts, which amount to, across the board, it's a very crude figure, roughly 4 to 5% reduction in all government spending programs a year for the next 4 or 5 years.
Okay.
Or put in another way, it rolls back those expenditures to the level at which they were, roughly speaking, in 2005, 2006. It's harsh. It does impact, no doubt, more severely on, if you will, the social underclass in this country than on others. But it hasn't really begun to bite yet because a lot of it is backloaded. When it does begin to bite, then the question is going to be, you know, to the extent that some of what has happened, I do think not much, but some of what has happened has been, if you will, empowered by the cuts. What happens when the cuts really begin to bite? But I'd like to take the opportunity, if I might,
yes,
to answer what Laurie Penny had to say on two issues, one of which was my use of the word feral. I was very careful to say that it was an incendiary word and one that is,
yes,
used,
indeed,
by the tabloid newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also the fact that I ride a train to my home outside London, 50 miles outside of London, and as much as possible I avoid taking the train long after dark. Precisely because there are very often large numbers of young people, mostly white, and it's an extremely threatening experience. It's an unpleasant experience. The best thing you can do when they are about is to sit in the train and keep your eyes down on your newspaper, lest you be accused of, you know, looking at these people.
Mm-hmm.
As very often their beer cans in their hand, and that's something we haven't discussed, which is a widespread binge drinking culture here. But I'd also say that when one listens to people who live in these neighborhoods, Laura Penny, your other guest, it's wise for people like me, and I don't live in such a neighborhood, to be very cautious and to listen very carefully to what they say. But what does trouble me in what Laura Penny says is that
there appears
to be nothing in her program which would allow for shutting down these riots. And it seems to me there's a very broad agreement here right across the political spectrum that something has to be done right away to stop it, because until it's stopped, we can't even have a civic debate.
Laurie, I'll bring that to you. John Burns, I just have you for a minute. You know the U.S. and the U.K. well. Is this a kind of dynamic that could jump the pond, or do you not sense this sort of tension in the United States, this sort of dynamic?
I have to be cautious about that. I've been a foreign correspondent for most of my career at,
yes,
the New York Times. I can only say this. When I joined the New York Times in the early 1970s, New York, even Central Manhattan, with a rather threatening place to move through at night. That changed. There are many, many reasons why it changed, and much argument about that, but it did change. And I have a feeling that much of this has been better handled in the United States, but then there would be millions of people in the American underclass who would mock me for saying that, I'm sure.
John Burns, Pulitzer Prize-winning London Bureau Chief for the New York Times, joining us today from London. Thank you very much for your time, John.
Not at all. It's a pleasure.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the riots in London and beyond in the UK, why they've happened, what they've meant, what we are seeing in night after night of fire and looting there. Here's the sound of riots on Monday night in the North London neighborhood of Hackney, where one of our guests today, Bim Adewunmi, lives. Screaming rioters, hurling bottles and rocks at police as helicopters flew overhead. British Prime Minister David Cameron cut his summer vacation in Tuscany short, returning from Italy on Monday to deal with the riots. He vowed yesterday to release the full force of the law on what he called thugs.
Let me first of all completely condemn the scenes that we have seen on our television screens and people have witnessed in their communities. These are sickening scenes, scenes of people looting, vandalizing, thieving, robbing, scenes of people attacking police officers and even attacking fire crews as they're trying to put out fires. This is criminality, pure and simple, and it has to be confronted and defeated.
All kinds of interpretation and debate over exactly what's being played out in the streets of London and Manchester and Birmingham and Liverpool. Here's David Lammy, an MP from Tottenham in London, where the protest began, telling NPR's Steve Inskeep on Morning Edition today that poverty is not a reason to riot.
I am a black member of parliament. I grew up poor. I grew up fatherless. I know what it is to struggle. But as my mother used to say, you can be poor, but you can still have pride. Politicians have to be really, really careful about the excuses that they are playing into this story, despite the profound, difficult economic backdrop, which I think is, of course, being accelerated by this government.
British MP David Lammy trying to parse it more or less down the middle there. Britons, call us, explain to us what you see going on. And Americans, what are you thinking as we all watch these fires of riot and looting in London and beyond? Bim Adewunmi is with us, journalist and blogger in the UK at YorubaGirlDancing.com. Laurie Penny is with us as well, journalist, activist, blogged for The New Statesman and The Guardian. Her blog is Penny Red. Sarah in Belmont, Massachusetts. Sarah, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I just wanted to say that I'm so happy to see the politicians and pundits in Britain that they've been exposed for the frauds that they are. Because for years, they've been proclaiming loudly that homegrown Islamic terrorism was the greatest threat, mm-hmm. and mosques were regularly raided with SWAT teams and helicopters for no reason. Mm-hmm. And now they clearly were unaware of the time bomb that was waiting to explode in their cities.
So, Sarah, yeah, what it, it sounds is you're thinking, perhaps as a Muslim, you feel some kind of redemption here, that this is not about Muslims in particular,
no,
what we're
not
seeing.
Not at all. Because judging from all the liquor stores that have been raided in every city and every town, it's not. No Muslims are involved in this. And so what I'm saying is that this kind of rioting and this kind of devastation destruction that's being wrought. I mean, this was a huge powder keg that they all willfully or because they're incompetent, they ignored.
Looking
and
the other way.
The politicians here and the pundits here should also maybe take notice, because the inner cities here are also full of hugely unemployed youths, and many similar situations exist.
Sarah, I appreciate your call very much, and thank you for it. David in Chesapeake, Virginia. David, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You know, I've been following this since the beginning, and you know, I have to agree that it is criminality. And you know, the BBC has done a great job in depth of coverage of this thing, and they've interviewed a lot of the looters. And just have a lot of video footage, and I have to disagree with one of the earlier panelists saying that there's a lot of white people and stuff involved. there's very minimal that I've seen in the video footage. And, you know, primarily it's been on black or mixed black. And, you know, and they clearly stated in their interviews, we're doing this because we can and we want to do it until we're stopped and, you know, we don't care. And, you know, and I think that the issues that go on in the UK, I mean, people here probably don't pay much attention to it, but I'm sure that you do. You stay up with everything. But, you know, what happens in the UK usually ends up happening here in the United States later on. Like, for instance, when they had the riots in the 80s, we ended up having riots in the 90s in L.A. And then, you know, things that happen with their economy or whatever happens a little bit here, too, as well, a little bit later on. And I think this is a sign of what's really going to happen here in the United States. The UK seems to handle things a lot differently because they don't have, I don't think, the guns on the streets like we do. So it's, I think ours are magnified. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when Cameron said, you know, in one of his speeches, he said, you know, this is criminality. You're not going to use human rights or civil rights to hide behind and sidestep the law. We're going to come after you. You know that in the United States, the media has not shown that speech. They've taken clips out of it, but they have not shown the video where he's stating the things about human rights and civil rights. And I think there's a reason for that. And his message clearly states that it is a target towards a racial, socio-economical problem. And it's just unfortunate that those people that are part of that, you know, just like here in the United States, they do sidestep the laws and using the racial and human rights.
Yeah, David, let us pick it up. We've got a lot of listeners with all kinds of perspectives on this. I'm hearing yours there. You say it does look like criminality to you, and you've got a kind of perspective of what's going on racially as well. Lori Penny, speak to that one for a moment. You know, here's an American watching. It looks criminal to him, and it doesn't look white. What do you say, Lori?
Well, firstly, it's absolutely not true that this is purely a black thing, or, as your previous caller said, entirely not a Muslim thing. I mean, the people we've seen out on the streets are of all races represented in London. They are, and they're not just young either, although they're the vast majority are teenagers. There have been some people spotted in their 30s. You know, white women looting an Evans cycle shop was reported by The Guardian yesterday. This is not purely a race thing. It is a class thing. And, I mean, to bring up that aspect of pride, which I think was mentioned earlier, is a really, really important element in that, you know, David Lammy, a Member of Parliament in the UK, saying, you know, you can be poor, but you can still have pride. What we have in this country we used to have a welfare system that gave people pride. We used to have a jobs market that gave people pride. People in deprived communities in Britain, and particularly in areas of inner cities and inner London, Manchester, Liverpool, areas like that, they have not... Children grow up without having respect shown to them once. They grow up being treated like criminals, being stopped and searched on their way home from school. They feel humiliated from day one. If people have not been shown respect, how do you expect them to show respect to anything around them? And this is not excusing or condoning violence, but I think if we write everything off as criminality and don't attempt to understand it... like your previous caller said, this is going to be like the canary in the cage. We have to pay attention to this. We can't just
Lori, hold the thought. I want
to
get one more call.
Off the poor.
We've got it. Sam in Somerville, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Sam.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Great topic. I'm looking at this from across the pond. I don't know what's going on in the minds of you know, the people who are doing what they're doing in England, but I know in my mind what occurs to me is that there's incredible criminality that was perpetrated against the whole world by the financial industry and bankers. And I know my sense of outrage and helplessness to watch that level of criminality go on with no consequences, no change in the law.
On Wall Street,
best of my knowledge, I don't think anyone's gone to jail. And this has been going on for years, since Enron. I think they, you know, what, two people went to jail? So, and that sort of criminality and economic violence pales in comparison to what we're going on now. So my point is that emotionally I've got a strong connection. It resonates with the sense of outrage and the sense of helplessness that I feel in the face of being preyed on by these financial predators.
In this country, and Sam, our time is so short. I appreciate your call. Bim, is it over, do you think? The threat of rubber bullets and water cannon is there now. The fight back, as David Cameron says. Is it over, Bim? What do you think?
I'm not entirely sure that it is. It might not flare up in the manner that we've seen in the last few days, but it, you know, having rubber bullets and water cannons will not get rid of the feelings that people still have. Now, I'm not entirely keen on the idea that it's all down to the cuts. I think that is willfully naive. Okay. There are issues about, because to be honest with you, many of the cuts haven't even come in yet.
Yes.
The EMA has been cancelled, but these cuts will bite far more in the years to come. But I do think that there's a lot of language of victimhood and victimization going on. Some of it is justified. Some of these people have basically been sidelined by society. And a lot of that is down to, and this is not a Tory thing, this is not a Labour thing only. It's all the governments that have been in place since the 70s.
Bim, we're people just up against angry. The clock here. We've got no? We're grateful to you for your time. I'm afraid we're out of time. Bim Adewunmi, she blogs at Yoruba Girl, YorubaGirlDancing.com. Thank you, Bim.
Thank you.
And Laurie Penny at Penny Red. Thanks for joining us, Laurie.
My pleasure. Thanks.
This is On Point. To bring it home, on Sunday, 45,000 union workers at Verizon, the big American telecommunications giant, went on strike. Picket signs, a sea of bright red shirts outside the New York headquarters. The unions are fighting cuts in their pensions, health care, and job security. It's a big labor action in the middle of a very down economy. Joining me now to look at the strike and what's behind it is Stephen Greenhouse, labor and workplace correspondent for the New York Times. Stephen Greenhouse, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
So first of all, Verizon. Some of our listeners will have it as their telecom provider. Others may never have heard of it. Where is it active in this country?
Verizon, in ways, is active throughout the United States. It's Verizon Wireless mobile phone service is a nationwide service.
Right.
The strike, Tom, doesn't involve directly the wireless customers. It involves landline customers, and that's from and only from Massachusetts down to Virginia, really mid-Atlantic and Northeast.
So the strike part of this, although you may have Verizon Wireless anywhere, the strike going on more in the East. And what's brought things to this point, Stephen? How did the strike explode?
You know, the contract expired, midnight Saturday night, and they weren't close to a deal. The company admits that it's asking for very aggressive concessions from the union. The company says that it's traditional landline business. You know, home phone lines is hurting as so many people, switch to mobile phones or as people use Skype instead of their landlines. They make calls for free in Skype. And the company says because its landline division is hurting, it needs lots of concessions to help reduce costs. And it's asking employees to contribute far more to health coverage than before. It wants to freeze pensions. It wants to reduce sick days. The union says, wait a second, this company is fabulously profitable, largely because of Verizon Wireless, which is not unionized.
Mm-hmm.
And the union says, and the top executives in the company are raking in lots of money. You know, the top four, five executives made $258 million total over the last 4 years. So the union says, why in the world are they asking us for concessions when the company is doing so well?
What about profitability? Is there any question on that front? Is Verizon doing well?
Verizon is doing well, although Verizon will say most of our profits come from our non-union operation, Verizon Wireless, and not from the landlines division, which is hurting. And, you know, Verizon Wireless, the mobile phone operation, is a joint venture in which Verizon owns 55%. And Verizon says, well, that's a good growing business. That's not unionized. The union workers don't work for that division, and they shouldn't so much enjoy share in the benefits of that division. They say, you know, the division that the unionized workers are in, the landlines division, is hurting, and they need concessions to, you know, make sure that business doesn't lose money.
It's the biggest strike in the country since, 74,000 GM workers walked out for a couple of days in 07.
Yes.
The head of Verizon is warning of a sort of a auto industry kind of path for Verizon's landline business if they don't cut costs.
Yes. Landlines, were a traditional business that go back, Alexander Graham Bell a long, long time ago, and it says this, like you know, he's been saying this, like the auto industry, is a declining industry and that it has high costs, and that for us to remain, for Verizon to remain competitive with, you know, cable companies, non-union cable companies that it competes with Skype, it really has to cut costs. And again, the union's response is we should look at Verizon as a united company, both wireless and so-called wirelines or landlines, and that this company, they say, has a very bright future. And they feel it's wrong for the company to say just because you're in the division, the landlines division, that in many ways helped finance the creation and expansion of the wireless division, they say they shouldn't be forced to swallow these huge concessions because they're in this side of the business that's not growing as much, that's declining in ways.
So let's look at exactly what the company is asking. You report that they want union workers to start contributing to their health care premiums, $1,300 to $3,000 a year toward family coverage, that they've called for freezing pension contributions for current employees, that limiting sick days to 5 per year, eliminating all job security provisions. Freezing pension contributions, meaning they just wouldn't go up? They'd stay exactly where they are?
They mean, Tom, if you worked for the company, say, for 15 years, and maybe after 15 years you're entitled to a pension of $25,000 a year when you retire, that if you work another 15 years at the company, you work 30 years, your pension will not go up. It will still remain at that same amount. However, Verizon is, you know, promising to create a more generous 401k plan. It still won't be as good as what people get with a, you know, good old pension plan where you get a certain amount each month once you retire.
Steve, it takes guts to strike in the middle of such a deep downturn with such high unemployment. What are the union's odds here? What are the dynamics? How do you foresee what?
It's, you know, it is a tough time to strike, and people might say, you know, you guys are out of your mind. The economy is so bad. So many people are unemployed. Why you're doing this? And the union says the company has just pushed us too far, and they feel it's, in ways, hypocritical of the company to say, we need these huge concessions from you when Verizon's overall profits are doing well and, you know, the CEO and others are paying themselves quite well. It's unclear how this is going to play out. You know, it's unclear whether the company sees this as a historic opportunity to really weaken the union seriously, and that's why it's demanding these many, many concessions, or whether the company has, you know, thrown these 100, you know, demands for concessions on the wall in the hope of just, you know, walking away with 3 or 4 significant concessions. It's unclear how it's going to play out.
Well, it's a big strike. 45,000 Verizon workers on strike now. Paychecks not in their pockets, and big question marks. Stephen Greenhouse, thank you very much for laying out the whole picture for us.
Thanks much, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
Stephen Greenhouse, labor and workplace correspondent for the New York Times. Listeners, you can continue today's conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.